This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is Dean Strang, author of a fascinating new book called Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Dean Strang, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So this isn't about the Haymarket trial, which people probably think of right away when they see anarchists, and justice in a subtitle or a title. Tell us what this one's about.
This is really about events that happened more than 30 years after Haymarket, although the principals allegedly were anarchists. The core of the book is the story of a trial that would be relatively insignificant today, but for the fact that it happens less than a week. It begins less than a week after a disastrous bomb blast at the Central Police Station in Milwaukee, and the entire trial of these 11 accused Italian immigrants happens in the pall, almost literally, of the smoke from the police station bombing, and the outcome, really, of the trial is foreordained by the mood of the moment and the disaster of the bomb blast.
And this was in Milwaukee. You grew up in Milwaukee. Did you know about this growing up, or how did you hear about the story in the first place?
I did not know about it growing up. I learned about it in the early 90s, really through my interest in Clarence Darrow, which had dated back to law school. And remain an amateur Darrow fan. Was poking around one night when I should have been working, just to see whether Darrow ever had appeared in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Out of just curiosity, as I say, wasting time when I should have been at work. Indeed, he had, and the case that caught my attention turned out to be this one, and as I read through the opinion, I discovered that the melee about which the trial, technically was a product of, that riot or melee had occurred on the corner of the block on which I then was living and lived for 15 years.
Huh, interesting. I'm speaking with Dean Strang. He's the author of a book called Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. It's about a bombing in Milwaukee in November 1917, almost 100 years ago, that killed 9 police officers. That was one of the biggest single, or perhaps the biggest single assault on police officers in Wisconsin history. But I knew nothing about this story, having lived in Wisconsin for 30 years and also studied a little bit informally anarchism. So it was interesting to hear and to figure out what happened. One of the peculiarities of this story was that the people who were arrested for the death of these police officers were in jail at the time, some of them.
All of them were in jail. Now, none of them actually were charged with placing the bomb or causing the death of the police officers, and for that matter, the police station was not the intended target of the bomb. The bomb had been placed against a church and then walked up to the police station by an innocent, a teenage boy from the church.
So tell me what happened at the trial and how defendants' rights were violated, in your opinion.
Well, the trial, as I say, on the surface, was supposed to be about a shooting fracas that had happened in a Italian working neighborhood of Milwaukee more than 2 months before the bomb went off. And there were 11 new immigrants from Italy who were charged with conspiracy to assault police officers with intent to kill them. Again, not having anything to do with the bombing at the police station, but with this fracas that had occurred down in a neighborhood called Bayview in September 1917. The state proceeded on a conspiracy theory against the 11. There really was no evidence that many of them had done anything at all or even were present when the melee occurred. But the district attorney and to some extent the judge very successfully wove the bombing in to the trial, wove in the anarchist ideology that they ascribed to these 11 people. Some of them probably did have anarchist leanings. Some of them probably did not. Many of them really had, I think, no organized political thought system at all, really. But the insinuation was that these all were anarchists, and if they weren't convicted for something, sooner or later they'd place a bomb somewhere near you.
And part of the what you get in the book, including some comments from Clarence Darrow on the subject, is just how undemocratic, how unjust the charge of conspiracy can be, how sweeping it can be, and how it's kind of a tool of kings, I think is what you quote Darrow was saying in there.
It was becoming then and remains now a favorite tool of prosecutors, because the idea is that all you really then need to do is prove that each of the accused joined an agreement to commit a crime and that some one or more of them then took concrete steps in furtherance of that agreement. And conspiracy law operates, in a sense, on an in-for-a-penny, in-for-a-pound principle, even today. So the most minor player, if he in fact agreed to commit offense A, then becomes responsible for all of the acts of his fellow conspirators, including ancillary crimes B, C, and D.
And that's still being used a lot by prosecutors today.
Oh, it's enormously popular in drug prosecutions, almost anything. More so in federal court than in state courts, typically. But it's a very popular theory of criminal liability.
And so all of the defense got nailed on that in this case and convicted?
All of them did at trial.
The, right.
As I say, 11 defendants, more than 3 weeks of testimony. The jury was out exactly 17 minutes,
oof,
and returned guilty verdicts against all 11.
17 minutes has got to be a indoor record.
It's not, unfortunately. But it's also not much time to consider the individual culpability of 11 people.
Well, that's one of the things you talk about. I mean, appeal, many of these defendants got off, and that the Wisconsin Supreme Court finally sorted through individual by individual and did some rough justice anyway at that point. Tell me about some of the interesting people who walked through this book. I mean, one is Emma Goldman. I always love hearing about Emma Goldman. So what'd you find out about her?
Emma Goldman is someone who, from the outset, almost from the arrests of these 11 Italian immigrants, becomes very interested in their cause, follows it from New York. She's the editor and the principal contributor to Mother Earth magazine at that time. She's very interested and very much aware of the dynamic here of police, mainstream press, public opinion. You know, we're in the early months of World War I. Patriotism is at a fever pitch. Fear of foreigners is rampant. And Emma Goldman had a very good sense of that, and I think a sense of foreboding about the prospects of 11 impoverished, you know, new immigrants to obtain justice in American courts.
A mom with a young kid that she was especially
right.
concerned about.
There were the 11 defendants were 10 men and one woman who was married to one of the other defendants, and they had a six-year-old boy. And it was one of the interesting human aspects of this story is the personal interest that Emma Goldman takes in that six-year-old boy. Her writing, private writing, reflects it. The magazine reflects it. After they were convicted, then, and unfortunately only then, she sort of led a nationwide effort to raise a defense fund on appeal. And I suspect strongly, although I couldn't prove conclusively in the end, that she's the link to bringing Clarence Darrow in to represent the 11 on appeal.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Clarence Darrow and his role here. I'm speaking with Dean Strang. He's the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Darrow comes in. You write that his colleague does most of the heavy lifting, which must be true in a lot of law firms where the most prestigious person just kind of comes in at the end and does the theatrics. Was that common for Darrow? Did he do a lot of the work himself usually, or was he just kind of
Darrow is a hard worker, but it really depends on what legal work you're talking about. Darrow was not primarily an appellate lawyer. He wasn't cut out for that. He was primarily a trial lawyer, and that's how we remember him. Now, the fact of the matter is that he was involved in more than 60 appeals in his career, but it's not how we remember him. His probably most loyal partner over the years was a man named Peter Sisman, who really was oriented toward the research, the writing, the office work, as opposed to the courtroom work that appeals required then and require now. So Darrow and Sisman teamed up on the appeal, and it probably is true that Sisman took the laboring oar.
How did you assess Darrow's role in the appeal ultimately?
Well, he succeeds if you measure that by the outcome in the state Supreme Court. Of the 11 defendants convicted to trial, 9 of them had a reversal in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. 7 of those 9, the court said, can't be tried again. As to some, there was just no evidence at all to support a conviction for any crime. As to others, there was. But the evidence sufficed only to prove misdemeanors. By that time, they had served more than a year in state prison, more than the total sentence they could have served on a misdemeanor. So they simply were freed by the state Supreme Court. As to 2 of the 9 who had their convictions reversed, the court said there was ample evidence to convict you, but the judge erred in allowing the jury to convict on a conspiracy theory. And the court, that is, the Supreme Court, said those 2 could be retried, but only on their own behavior, their own conduct, not on the actions of others, not on a conspiracy theory. The state, of course, elected never to retry those 2.
And then you get into a kind of shady deal that you argue it's possible that Darrow was involved with here, and as far as getting a pardon for the 2 who were convicted. Talk about that. How'd you stumble on that?
Well, this is really, at least for someone who's very interested in Clarence Darrow, this is the sort of unexpected gem in the story, or a hidden story in itself. There was testimony in a grand jury proceeding 4 or 5 years after the appeal that came from the man who had been the assistant district attorney at the trial, had assisted the Milwaukee County District Attorney in prosecuting these 11. He testified in 1922 in the grand jury, as I say, 4 or 5 years after the trial, that in the early days of the appellate process, when he and his boss were tired of the death threats they were getting, and in at least one case, an overt attempt on the district attorney's life, they took the train down to Chicago from Milwaukee, met with Clarence Darrow, whom the district attorney knew, and according to the sworn testimony of this assistant district attorney, there they agreed with Darrow that if he would reach out and try to get the Italian community to call off the attacks on the 2 prosecutors, they would participate in falsifying the trial record to try to assure that the Wisconsin Supreme Court would reverse the 11 convictions on manufactured error.
So this wasn't about the pardon itself. This was about the at the Supreme Court.
The role of the district attorney, and for that matter the trial judge, in helping secure the pardon of the two defendants whose convictions were affirmed by the Wisconsin Supreme Court is only corroboration that this meeting in Darrow's office in fact resulted in an agreement to try to corrupt the appellate process. Now, in the end, we can't prove that it actually happened, but as I say, there is the corroboration that the district attorney and the judge, who had taken such a dim view, such an aggressive attitude against these 11 defendants, wound up writing a letter to the governor supporting a pardon or commutation of the sentence of the two whose convictions were affirmed.
Which is very unusual for a judge to do that, isn't it?
It would be almost unheard of today. I don't know that it was necessarily as unusual back then, but in a high-profile case like this that was viewed as serious, a case in which the judge had imposed 25-year prison sentences across the board, it's pretty striking, especially in the context of the testimony that the assistant prosecutor gave in the grand jury.
And so, if true, what does that make of our picture of Clarence Darrow?
Well, it adds one more incident in which his legal ethics fairly can be questioned. And again, the proof isn't conclusive that in the end these folks did tamper with or falsify the trial record. The prosecutor left his job shortly after the supposed agreement was struck in Chicago. He didn't know, or at least testified that he didn't know, whether Darrow and his boss, the district attorney, ever carried through on it. But it raises one more question, and there are several, about Darrow's methods and ethics, the most well-known being the jury bribery accusations on which he stood trial in Los Angeles in the wake of the McNamara brothers case that stemmed from the bombing of the Los Angeles Times.
And what if someone listening would say, well, he was just being a good lawyer for his clients, doing whatever he could to get him off?
No, if he did this, he was doing something more than that. But Darrow was someone who recognized that the police, the Pinkertons, you know, private detective agencies, prosecutors, all fought with bare knuckles back then. And he was someone who probably, in the right case, would take the position that the end justifies almost any means.
And he did defend some of the Wobblies who were victims of some of that worst kind of violence, and Eugene Debs, for that matter. My guest this week is Dean Strang, author of a fascinating new book called Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. It's a fascinating account of something I knew nothing about, which was a violent incident in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, back in November 1917, almost 100 years ago, when 9 police officers were killed by a bomb that was supposed to blow up a evangelical preacher who was interfering in the Italian community and trying to convert people from Catholicism, and didn't go over very well there. But, you know, this is something that happened decades and decades ago. What's the relevance for today? Why should we be interested in this today?
Every player, every institutional actor we look at, in this case from 1917, the police, the prosecution, the defense lawyers, the judge, and then the commercial press, the mainstream media, who I include as an actor in our broader system of criminal justice, every one of those institutions and the people within them proved themselves terribly human in this case. Their biases were on full display, their weaknesses, their human frailties. There may have been corruption in the end, as I say, in the appeal. The district attorney himself had a long record, it turns out, of personal corruption. And, you know, in the end, here, unjust convictions in the main were reversed, but in part, by corrupt means. I mean, it may be here that in some sense a corrupted system found its redemption only in a further effort at corruption. Mm. And the broader lessons, I think, are that our system of justice really is human in all of its components. It's frail in the way that human beings are frail. And we really ought be leery of arguments for finality in outcomes, in arguments that the truth is established by any verdict, and wary about our reliance on institutions like law enforcement, like courts.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the more interesting things that comes out of the book. The book is Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. You say that the problems of our legal system back in the early part of the 20th century, 1917, when this occurred, still have not been rectified by and large, which is a very strong claim, but you argue it. Tell me
why. I do. I think you can look at a trial in 1917 or probably at any other moment in American history. And while there certainly are striking procedural differences and technological differences from a trial today, the basic human failings and their potential to subvert a search for justice really remain unchanged. I think the problem too, Matt, is most acute at moments of great public fear, of nativism and a concern about foreigners or some foreign menace. Wartime.
I mean, this is what came out to me when I was reading this book, and I have to say I read it in manuscript form, too, and did a little bit of handiwork on it, that coming after 9/11, I mean, the anti-immigrant hysteria, the, you know, terrorist, anarchist, whatever you want to call it, is very comparable. The role of the press that you mentioned is very similar. The runaway patriotism, jingoism, whatever you want to call it, all of that was so reminiscent in your book of what was going on just in the last 10 years.
Oh, sure. And these moments have recurred throughout U.S. history. I mean, in the 20th and early 21st century alone, I mean, you know, World War I is an unprecedented global conflict. Americans are rightly fearful and
boy, and you have Teddy Roosevelt concerned. Saying some real nasty things about fighting Bob La Follette, the founder of the Progressive Movement, Progressive Magazine.
I quoted him accurately. And, you know, and so this moment of fear and a sense of potential global collapse coincides with a strong sentiment against immigrants generally and certainly immigrants who are suspected of radical ideology. World War II and the years after that, leading to the Korean conflict, communists, you know, take the place of anarchists or labor radicals in the World War I era. And you have the Vietnam conflict and civil rights era, black nationalists, other radicals. And, you know, we carry to our present day where the concern is radical Islamists and these concerns become magnified and the fear becomes more intense when coupled with a state of war or an act of war, as we experienced here on our own land on September 11.
I mean, you had the roundups of Italian-Americans back in 1917. There were roundups of Muslim-Americans forced, you know, come report to the government. And then, of course, all the infiltration.
Japanese-Americans during World War II.
I mean, you see these things. One other thing that I want you to talk about is, to what extent do we have constitutional protections? I mean, like the Fourth Amendment has just been so chipped away at by one court decision after another that it in practice is almost null and void, isn't it?
Well, it's not null and void. You can argue about the extent to which the Fourth Amendment has been on life support, and I think, you know, the reality is that our constitutional protections always are at risk. They are never popular in the broader sense. They're popular only when we personally need them. You look at this case. On September 9 and September 10, 1917, in the immediate aftermath of the fracas in Bayview, the police were going door to door, knocking doors down without warrant, arresting people en masse. Arrest them now, sort them out later, and release them in due time if you can't make something stick. Holding them incommunicado for days or weeks. Third-degree interrogation methods. Now, a lot of that procedurally is better at some level today. You know, we don't beat confessions out of people as a rule today. The police are much more sophisticated in using psychological techniques in interrogation. But the point remains that it's easy in a time of crisis for law enforcement and public institutions generally to overreact and to view constitutional protections as niceties that really have to yield in a crisis.
Speaking with Dean Strang, he's the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. I mean, after 9/11, the government used the material witness statute just to grab people and hold them. And
used it abusively, with really very little public outcry over it. So again, the basic human impulse remains, and it's a recurrent problem. So I think in that sense, this is one of many stories we could tell about American legal history that has some cautionary messages that we ought to carry with us.
And we only have a couple minutes left. What do you encourage people to do who are concerned about our justice system, which, interesting, you got a great line in your book. It's not a system of justice, but a system of chance, and a cruel one at that. I love that line.
Well, don't give up on it, but don't trust it blindly either. And please, I guess, you know, in my own view, I cringe every time I pick up a newspaper or watch the evening news with the mainstream media speaking to me about authorities say this or officials say that. And there's sort of a dehumanization, in a sense, that comes with those labels that invests these people with a kind of infallibility that none of us have and that none of them have. And we need to, I think, keep firmly in mind the reality that all of these people, federal agents, judges, lawyers on both sides, we're all human. We all make mistakes. We all have limited foresight, and we all act on, you know, the bundle of biases and weaknesses that constitute us.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. I think that's good advice for all of us with this justice system that isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and with this very powerful government and very weak press and the susceptibility to ideology and hatred and blind patriotism, which is so often part of what I call the American superiority complex. Dean Strang has been my guest today. Dean Strang is the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. Dean, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.